Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Hello, everybody, and I'm excited about this show and this subject matter. My guest today is Dr. Paul Corona. He's an MD. He's a Southern California-based physician, so he's not far from where I am. And he's reshaping the future of psychiatry and family medicine. And he's also the author of 4 books, and we're going to be talking about those. But first, let me just say, welcome to the show, Dr. Corona.
Thank you, Marcia. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the subject. And before we start sort of delving into the meat of the subject, I think it's always great to know who is my guest. So could you just please tell us a little bit about yourself personally?
Yeah, I grew up in a really great family in Southern California, in the Los Angeles South Bay area. And I was growing up, I always was fascinated with science and puzzles and math. And I tell this story about when I was like 5 years old and a Christmas, our family doctor, who's also a good friend of our family, gave me one of those little kids' doctor bags. And
oh.
I remember I was fascinated by that thing. And I remember that, you know, I quickly opened, I self-medicated quickly on the candy pills. And then I carried that thing around with me, and I was, you know, pretending I was taking people's blood pressure and listening to their heart. And then I got the nickname Dr. Paul. So I got the nickname Dr. Paul when I was like 5 years old. And I remember
oh,
from
funny.
Back then, I always wanted to be a doctor. And growing up, it's what I said, you know, when I was younger, I said, people would ask me when I was in elementary school, you know, in middle school and high school, what do you want to be? Oh, I want to be a doctor. You know, and there was never any wavering from that. It's the only thing I ever wanted to be. And I'm not sure why it grabbed me so young, but I just thought, you know, I love science so much. And I just, there was no other really career path I saw. So then I got into USC, actually the only school I applied to, the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Went there for 4 years as a pre-med biology major. I got accepted to 6 medical schools, but I decided
Ooh.
At the time that I really wanted to live. I got accepted to 2 in California and 4 back east. And so I basically decided to go to medical school in New York because I wanted to experience something different. I thought, well,
sure.
I knew I wanted to come back to California to live and retire. But I thought, you know, I have 4 years where I could live somewhere else. So between Boston, Philadelphia, New York, I chose New York because it's New York. And so I went there for 4 years of medical school, a great experience there. Living in Manhattan was an exciting time, of course, being in my early 20s.
What school was that you went to, Dr. Paul? What school in New York did you go to?
It's called New York Medical College. It's in Westchester
okay.
County.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It's a town called Valhalla. I spent a couple years there, and I spent a couple years in the city. And then, great experience. And with the end of med school, you have to decide like, what do you want to do in your life? You know, what kind of medicine you want to practice? And I really didn't know at the time because I liked, except for surgery, I liked pretty much everything else. I liked OBGYN. I liked pediatrics. I liked adult medicine. I liked psychiatry. I didn't really know because I liked a little of everything. And so I chose to be a family doctor because of the fact that, you know, I thought, well, this is a way I can kind of do a little bit of everything and be a well-rounded physician. And so I chose that. I came back to downtown Los Angeles to a hospital, 3-year training program at California Medical Center in Los Angeles, and did a training and family practice there. And then after that, I moved down to Orange County, and I've been living down here ever since. So that's kind of the basics of me and growing up and my journey to that point.
Anybody a doctor in your family before you?
Nobody. So I didn't have any really like role models. It just that I just, you know, it was just I thought that there was it's the way I could help people. That being a doctor, I saw is the way I could really help people. And the fact that I always had good grades and did well in school. And I thought, well, of any career, I thought it would probably be the most satisfying, and it really has been. I chose very well.
That's terrific. Well, you know, when we talk about psychiatry, how did your family medicine background bring you to the unique perspective of psychiatry?
Well, you know, family and being a family doctor, you do get training in psychiatry. That's part of our training for the 3 years. Is we have a psychiatrist and a psychologist that train us. You know, we don't maybe have as much of the psychiatric training as a psychiatrist would, but we do get a sizable amount of training, outpatient, inpatient, as part of being a family doctor. But I think what happened with me is that starting in the early 90s, I was always interested in the psychiatric medications too. And at the time we had like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil. We had three what we call SSRIs, so which are medications that work on the chemical serotonin. And so what happened is that this new medication came out, and I don't want to get too much detail, but there was a medication that came out called Effexor XR, and it was the first medication that worked on serotonin and the chemical called norepinephrine. And it sounds like not that big a deal, right? Well, I started seeing with my patients a really big deal. I started to see with patients telling me, oh my gosh, what is this? And I said, well, because sometimes the other ones, the Prozac, the Zolofts, you know, or now Lexapro is a big one now. They cause side effects. They give incomplete results. They make some people worse. So I've had limited, you know, I've had some success in a sense. But when this Effexor came out, I started seeing like a whole other world of difference with, especially the physical elements. Like I started seeing people say to me, my headaches are gone, my neck and shoulder tension is better, my stomach is better. So I started to see there was a physical element going on here. And as a family doctor, I was really seeing this. I was focusing on this because we, as family doctors, we look at the physical, you know, but I started to see this connection with the brain. And that's what really, drew my interest in the 1990s.
Well, you know, for those of us that may not know the difference, and I'm a person that loves definitions, what's the difference between psychiatry and psychology?
So psychologists are counselors. So the psychologists don't prescribe medications. So the biggest difference, psychiatrists prescribe medication. Now, there's some psychiatrists that do psychotherapy. No, I don't do it. But there's some, especially the older psychiatrists. The younger psychiatrists don't really tend to do it. Most of our focus is medications. But the psychologists basically are, you know, either PhDs in psychology or family therapists. You know, or sometimes social work. Sometimes social workers do counseling. So yeah, so basically, they're the ones that do therapy. They'll sit there with you for like 45 minutes to an hour, going over everything, your problems, your troubles. And I do that too, but I don't spend as much time as that as they do. And my focus is really getting their brain balanced and getting their neurochemistry on track, and that's the focus of my practice. So that's kind of the simple definition is one can prescribe medication in psychiatry and one can't.
That's I think that's great, and maybe I'm not the only one that didn't really understand that difference. So let's talk about this. I'm sure it is. Let's talk about the Corona Protocol. What makes your treatment methods revolutionary in the realm of psychiatry?
Well, I think what I was just saying about when I started to notice that there was a connection with the brain and body. I think primary care doctors focus on the body and ignore the brain, and I think psychiatrists focus on the brain and not the body. And so what I started to see is I started to see more complete results emotionally and physically. And so the way I started even just choosing a medication, just a simple example is the first medication most of the time chosen in my field is an SSRI. So an SSRI is basically
that? How do you spell
so
that,
it's SSRI, so selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So
okay.
The problem is in the nervous system is that chemicals start to leak. So chemicals start to go out of balance in the system because of leakages in the cells. And why this happens, we can go over now. The reason it happens is genetics is the main reason it happens, runs in families. Hormonal changes, like puberty and menopause mm-hmm. and postpartum, PMS, trauma, So these things can throw the chemistry out of whack in the system. And that's the basic problem. And how psychotropic medications work is by attaching to where I think the leakages are occurring and rebalance those chemicals. So most people don't know that. Most people don't understand how antidepressants mm-hmm. work, how mood stabilizers work. But that's all they do. They're not Band-Aids. They're not cover-up medications. They're actually getting to the core of the problem by balancing a person's chemicals that are out of balance. And they're out of balance for reasons the person has no control over. So, I mean, just the simple fact that I started to see that SSRIs were not the best first-line medication for a lot of patients, and that's pretty much heresy. All of the psychiatrists and all the textbooks say otherwise. They all think that SSRIs are the be-all and the end-all, and I've found out that they're not, and they're not as good as SNRIs, so serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. So that adding that second chemical, norepinephrine, I found was really big. And so that was the first step of the Corona Protocol, is that one simple issue. The other issue mm-hmm. is getting people completely well. So a lot of doctors get people a little bit better, but not completely well. Now, completely well we call remission. So remission mm-hmm. means getting people to that state of themselves again. So I'm not satisfied until I hear a person telling me I feel back to my old self again, or I've never felt this good. And most people mm-hmm. say my old self is either elementary school, late teens, early mid 20s. So my goal is to get everyone there. And to do that, you need to put medications together. And that's kind of something that not a lot of doctors know how to do well, because it's not really taught very well in the textbooks and in psychiatry, is how to put things together. And so the Corona Protocol is really how to combine different medications with different mechanisms of action together in order to get really complete results, so that they're better, their energy is better, their sleep, their physical body. So it's not just I'm not depressed as much anymore. It's everything's better. The anxiety is better. The body is better. Everything. So when I ask people these questions, every visit I'm looking to get people to that state of remission where they feel completely well. And that's what most doctors don't do, including psychiatrists, is they don't complete what they start. And they don't know, and they don't know how to. They don't know how to do it because the books don't really tell them how to do it. I've read psychiatric textbooks, so I know. And that's why mm-hmm. I started reading them. I kept wondering in the 1990s, why aren't doctors picking up on this? Why aren't doctors doing more than they are? And that's what really always confused me in this field, is I just didn't understand why. I was talking to doctors when I went to lectures and I went to conferences and trying to pick their brains as far as, are you seeing this? And I was just not hearing other doctors talking about what I'm talking with you about right now. It was just not done. So,
well, when we hear this phrase, mind-body medicine, which was what you've been talking about, how does this approach offer just a more holistic treatment model?
Well, because of the fact that I love the word holistic, because I think
too.
The word holistic, it means different things to different people. So with most people, when they think holistic, think vitamins, supplements, eating well, which is important, and, you know, or reflexology or chiropractic or acupuncture. I think all these things have value. I mean, let's take case in point acupuncture and even chiropractic.
Mm-hmm.
You loosen up the joints and the muscles. You put the needles here. And then I think the acupuncture is what they're doing with the needles is they're balancing the nervous system in ways that they learned how to do thousands of years, way before Western
mm-hmm.
medicine. So I think we're doing the same thing in a sense, is to try to create this balance, this optimal balance of the nervous system. And that's what I term holistic in the Western medical sense is helping the body heal itself. And with medications is that's exactly what they do. They help the body do what it can't do on its own. And
wow.
they do it at a very deep level. I mean, you can't get any deeper than the cell membrane. Remember, a mind-blowing statistic is in the nervous system, there's over 100 billion nerve cells. And there's over 100 trillion connections between the cells in one body. And chemicals are traveling around your body about 1,000 times a second. So there's a lot going on in our nervous system at one time. And so if you start having like leakages, it throws the whole balance of your system off. And so these we call it neurochemical imbalances. So these imbalances happen, again, for the reasons I stated earlier. And with psychotropic medications, it puts them back in balance. So that's why I call what I do holistic medicine. Now some people may disagree with me and they say, oh, that's not
mm-hmm.
holistic. You're using pharmaceuticals, you know, because a lot of people have an anti view of pharmaceutical because they think it's, you know,
I see.
That, you know, because they think, well, I don't want to go to the pharmacy. I want to get it at the health food store. I want to get it from a supplier. But,
I see.
You know, a lot of it's just because people don't really understand what these medications are about and how good they are. And if you just do it, if it's just a simplistic, well, I don't like Western medicine. I don't like big pharma. And I get it. I'm not a fan of big pharma either. So, but the one thing they do well is they do produce certain medications that are really good. And there's a lot of bad, but there's also a lot of good. And so we can't just discount that and just paint everything
mm-hmm.
in one broad brush and say, oh, well, medication, I want to do anything but medications. Well, good luck with that, because it's going to be
mm-hmm.
difficult to get back into balance without really addressing it in a deep and in a substantial way.
Well, so let me ask you, and this is another one of those words that would be a good definition. So do you think that supplements are useful? Are these medications that you're suggesting, are those considered supplements, or is supplements something other than what you're doing?
Supplements are different, but there are a lot of supplements that try to do what I'm doing. So,
mm-hmm.
So supplements would be over the counter. So supplements don't need a prescription like what I work with do.
Oh, okay.
But ones that I would categorize would be, some people have heard of SAMI, St. John's Wort, 5-HTP. Well, those are all working on serotonin, but the difference is, These are adding serotonin to the system. But the problem with that theory is that it's not a lack of serotonin. And a lot of people think that, oh, I'm going to boost my serotonin level. That's fine. It can help actually temporarily, because it does boost the serotonin level, but it doesn't fix the leakages. And so the more you add in, it's still going to go the wrong way if you don't fix those leaks. And so that's
mm-hmm.
the thing is that it's kind of operating by a principle that's not correct, but it's not that they hurt. And some patients have told me that they help. And so I'm not going to discount
mm-hmm.
that. And then there's tryptophan, there's GABA, which helps to relax people relax. And so there's supplements.
When you say GABA,
are you
talking gabapentin?
Yeah. Well, GABA, that's a prescription form, but yeah, but there's also
right.
gabapentin, but there's also over the counter GABA, which is, which is a GABA supplement. And they, and you know, they don't work as well as gabapentin do. I mean, gabapentin is a great medication. They don't work. They're not as powerful as that, but they do have a calming effect. There's no question they do help some people. So some people who are completely anti-pharmaceuticals will get by okay with those. But I think they could probably do a lot better if they would just get to the point and say, hey, look, maybe I'm wrong about pharmaceuticals. Maybe I should give it a shot. And a lot of people, you know, have had bad experiences too. A lot of people have gone to doctors. They've been given the wrong things. They have bad experiences. Doctors are not very good communicators typically. And so some people say, oh, I've already tried that approach. I don't want to, I'm going to stick to the holistic approach because I've tried the Western approach. And well, maybe you tried, and maybe you've gone to the wrong doctor. Maybe you tried the wrong medications. Maybe you know, maybe you should give me a chance because maybe I can find the right path for you. But you know, but hopefully, you know that. But that's a person that I'd love to get a hold of because, look, I, when you say you've tried those things, you know, I bet you haven't tried the right things.
And then, is there blood work that you do that would be like regular testing to see what your levels are to determine from a physicality of what this medication is doing, or is it strictly talking from this, I'm feeling so much better kind of, you know, oral discussion?
The latter. So there is no really, there's no blood. I mean, there is DNA testing. It's not exact, but that it helps sometimes. But there's no blood test because the reason there's no blood test is these are neurochemicals, and they're not blood. So the blood tests are really, I mean, doctors do it, but they're pretty useless. But that's one of the things that makes the people doubt that they're real. It's like, well, show me on paper that show me some blood tests. Like, well, you know, well, even if I took out some spinal fluid and did a spinal tap and looked at the spinal fluid, that's not going to give the answers either because it's not the level in the spinal fluid. It's the imbalance at the nerve cells. And we can't test that at all in any modern way that we know of, you know. And so that's why I think that's why people have a hard time accepting it because the people say, well, it's just too, I need to be proven. I need to see more than just like, am I feeling better or not? But hey, feeling better is pretty powerful, and that's a pretty
good
solution.
Isn't that the goal? Yeah, I would say, but exactly. I guess what I'm thinking is, so you're that patient on those medications. Is that something you're on for a lifetime?
Sometimes, yes. No, I've had patients go off of them and do fine. I think it has a lot to do with the situation. So, for example, if someone is totally fine for a while, and all of a sudden, like a trauma happened, like a death in the family, a close loved one. I mean, the worst is death of a child, of course, but death of a parent, death of a sibling. So sometimes some really acute trauma happens, and people get into a depression, and then, you know, we don't typically medicate grief, but if the grief is longer lasting, then they may be helped by medication. And then, sometimes they get past that, time passes, and then we go off and they're fine. If it's more of a chronic issue, if it's more something that's been with the person for a long time, or they've had it since puberty, which is a very common time it starts. So if it's more of a long lasting thing, it's very strong family history of it, because genetics tells us a lot when we explore family history. Then there's a person that's probably going to have a more chronic problem. The only way of really, I mean, even the textbooks don't really tell us the answer to that question because they'll say, oh, 6 to 12 months and then take people off of things. Well, the problem is a lot of times we take people off of things and they end up reverting right back to where they were. But most people, a lot of people want to do that. They say, let me try going off. I go, okay. And I tell them how to do it. And then some of them have success. A lot of them come back and say, well, that didn't work out very well. I said, okay, well, all that's telling us is that it's a more of a chronic problem. If you had a low thyroid, you take thyroid. If you had diabetes, if you had this, if you have blood pressure. Tell people in ways that they understand that, look, if it was this or that, you probably wouldn't have a problem taking something longer term. And I tell them, I said, this is your brain vitamin. This is something your brain really likes and wants in order to function properly. So if I talk to people in those types of terms, they really understand, then they get it, and then they don't have a problem with it.
Well, I like that brain vitamin. That's very interesting. What are your thoughts about educating healthcare providers that maybe don't know very much about this?
Well, that's my next goal. you mentioned four books. I wrote three already. I've written
right.
the new one. The new one's my sixth book. So after my first three, I wrote a fourth and fifth book in between. And I wrote these fourth and fifth books actually before I even knew about the sixth one, the current one, after I finished the first three. And what I was thinking at the time is, okay, I finished my first three books. Okay, now what? And I thought to myself, well, you know what? I need to do more than that. I need to teach. And so my thought was, I really need to teach primary care doctors because I'm one of them. I think they might respect me because I'm a very unusual story, being a family doctor and doing this full time for over 20 years. And so I want to teach. And there's not only primary care, but there's a lot of nurse practitioners and physician
right.
assistants out there who don't have the level of training that a doctor has. And so their knowledge is not as complete. And so there's a lot of people, there's a lot of doctors out there, or, you know, we call mid-level practitioners, who really need more training. And so these books I've written, my fourth and fifth books, are really for people for training. So I want to set up a training program, maybe online or some other way. But that's one of the future goals is for me to teach and to take what I've learned and then try to help more people, because the frustration I know is that there's so many people out there suffering, and that need help. And I feel like it does get to me, the fact that I know that they could be helped and they're not. And I know that I can do, if I can do something to help people beyond my patients, because I can only see so many people, then that's what I want to do. I want to help other providers help their patients. And that's how I want to give back, is by kind of paying it forward and doing what I can to change the whole situation as far as lack of knowledge about this subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like that. I'm just curious. Have you found that mental health is particularly stigmatized among men? I think I'm going to know the answer to this. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's what I would think.
Yeah, men are more difficult to treat. I just saw a guy today in my office, and I see a lot of PTSD. I see a lot of veterans and evaluate them for PTSD and treat them. And this guy, he was, you know, he was a Marine Corps, two deployments to Afghanistan. He has PTSD. He has traumatic brain injury. But, you know, it took me, you know, I told him, at the end of my evaluation of him, I said, you know, I really want to help you. You deserve it. You know, you've helped our country. You've tried to defend us. And I said, you really need help with this. Has anyone ever offered you help? He goes, no, no one has there. I go, well, I'd like to help you. And it took a long time to get him to, you know, his wife was on the phone with him, because it was a phone visit, but his wife was on the phone. And I just said, I understand you're a soldier, you know, you don't want to display signs of weakness. And that's men in general. That's the macho thing. It's
right.
the, you know, I don't want to look weak, and I don't want to display, I don't want to be, yeah, come off as weak. And especially with a soldier, I mean, with a soldier in the military, okay, that's even another level. But after explaining to him, I think I got him to the point where he's going to try something, and which I'm glad. It's tough, and it's just communicating with men, and sometimes it works, and sometimes frankly it doesn't. I try. I think women are easier, because women understand that they're not in control of their bodies. they go through childbirth, they go through, you know, and so they realize that the bodies are controlling and in control. And men, I don't think men have the same innate sense of that as women do. And women are just more open anyway. Women are more accepting, more open. Women are better listeners than men are. So I think that's kind of a generalized, I don't mean to be sexist here, but that's kind of a general view of women versus men.
Yes. Well, I my husband is deceased, but, I can't imagine, and with an electrical engineering background, so he's scientific, he would never talk about anything like that. I mean, I don't know if he would, I don't know if I would ask him if he was here, would you have seen that as a sign of weakness? I mean, if something was really troubling you, this just seems, to me, it just seems logical that you would get yourself in a place where a professional could assist you with that, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you've mentioned your writing, and frankly, you threw something at me that I wasn't aware of. I was only aware of 4 books you've written, so we'll get to that 5th book in a moment. But I thought we could just talk about your writing journey. And so when did you – because you've got 3 in a series. It's called Healing the Mind and Body, and you've written 3 books in that series. Am I right about that? Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you write your first book?
So my practice started, my training in L.A. was from 1989 to 1992, and I moved down to Orange County in California in 92 and started, in practice. And, it started as a family doctor, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed being a family doctor. But, again, the psychiatry part of this field, during the 90s, it really got hold of me, and I started doing more and more and more of it, and to the point where – probably about the year 2000, more or less, I was at the point where I was like, I was doing so much of this, and then I was trying to do it both. And I was just working way too many hours, staying late, working on weekends, trying to fit everything in. And then I came to the conclusion, I have to make a choice here. I really have to choose what I'm doing with my career here. And I started to see with psychiatry that I was making these discoveries that I wasn't reading about, and that I was seeing amazing results in my practice that I was not reading about or have. And they would tell me, I've been to psychiatrists, I've been to this doctor, that, and no one's gotten me feeling like this in years. And so I started to see, I'm obviously catching on to something here. So it was a very difficult decision because giving up my practice, and having a lot of angry patients tell me how unhappy they were with me. That wasn't easy, and because I was the head of a group at that point. I formed a group, and I was trying to pass my primary care patients to my partners, and the patients were not happy about the transition, and some of them left, and it was a tough time for me because I was questioning, am I doing the right thing? Maybe I should try to continue to do both, but I knew that it was, this was my calling. I knew I had to pursue it full time. I just knew. And so I ended up giving up primary care, and I still miss it to a lot of time. But so when I started doing it, after a couple of years, I think it was about 2002 to 2003 is when I started thinking about, I'm still perplexed as to why I'm not seeing doctors, picking up on this stuff. And so I need to write about it because who's going to believe me? Who's going to believe what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing if I don't write about it? If I write a book about it, maybe people will take me seriously. Maybe they'll think, he's not quote unquote just a family doctor, but maybe he has something to offer. So I titled it Healing the Mind and Body because that's, going back to the whole mind body connection, or I call mind body medicine. What I do is healing it. So that's why I came up with the title. When I started writing at that time, I just, I kept writing. And after about 4 years, I had about 800 pages of material. And, and I thought, and I threw some of it out. I thought, but I had a lot of material. I said, this is just too much for one book. So I basically split it off and say, this seems to be a good place to stop this first one. Mm-hmm. So let me stop this one and start number 2. So that's what led to book number 2. So it was never like a situation like, I'm going to stop this book and now I'm going to start a whole other one with another. It was basically just a continuation of the same thing. It's just more subjects. I talk about depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, ADD, all these different subjects, but it was just way too much material for just one book. And then I finished the first book with a chapter called The Art of Medicine, explaining how what I did is really more of like an art form. It's really more artistic than just plain just science. because of the, you know, because, you know, that's what psychiatry is it's really art. And so then when I started the second one, it was just, like I said, it was just a splitting off and just a continuation of what I was doing. And then I was able to fit other subjects in the second one, you know, like
what,
more
for
on
example?
Anxiety, like stress okay. reduction techniques, you know, talking to people about, you know, meditation, yoga, guided meditation, you know, so I just stuff that I didn't have enough time to do in the first book, in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and, you know, so that was basically the second one. And then the first one took me about 4 years, and then the second one took me about another 4 years.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
I got to interrupt you there, because obviously, you know, that 4 years isn't a day or two. And
right.
But you've got a thriving practice. There's only 24 hours in the day. I believe you have a family, right? You have children.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
yeah, they're young children back then. Yeah.
So, I mean, work balance is important with life balance. So, just out of curiosity, I've had a lot of authors on my show.
Yeah.
When you would start to write that very first book, was it because you had, did you like journal, or how did you gather the information and then put it succinctly into that first book? What was your process like?
You know, since I've never been trained as a writer, I really didn't know what I was doing. I kind of had an outline in my brain, but I didn't. It's not like I planned it out. I just kind of just talked about whatever I talked about, and I said, like, "Here's a chapter here." So I was winging it the whole time, really. I kind of had a slight outline of what I was going to do, but I didn't really know what I was doing, so I just kind of kept doing it. And why did it take me so long? Well, partly like what you just said, I had other stuff. I had a full practice. I have a family. So I'd probably try to fit it on some weekends, some evenings here and there. So, yeah, it took a long time. If I would have just done it full time, it wouldn't have taken me 4 years. So it took
right.
me that long because I had other stuff I was doing. And,
And so when you compiled so much information, what I understood you to say, that it was way more than one book could withhold. So that's, you sort of carried it over to book two. Is that what you did?
Exactly. So book two, yeah. So book two, I just kind of kept going, and I just covered subjects that I wasn't able to get to in book one. You know, and so that's what led to book two. But book two is another, like, you know, 350 pages. And
uh-huh.
then what was happening, well, no, that it was happening, I came up with another 800 pages for book two.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I started with a couple few hundred pages, but then it came to 800. And I go, okay, well, this is, again, just like I thought with the first book, this is too long for one book. So when I first started mm-hmm. writing the first book, I had no idea it would turn into three. I had absolutely no idea. And then I was talking to my daughter, who is a very good writer, and that's what she's doing full time now. But she, you know, I was talking to her, I was like, what do I do here? This book is too long. Maybe I should shorten it. She goes, well, Dad, just make another book out of it. I was like, duh. You know, I did that already with the first book. I don't know why I couldn't come up with that conclusion, because I thought I was just trying to fit into two books. And then I just decided, well, and why did I? And then the last chapter of the second book is called The Human Being, The Ultimate Living Puzzle. And I, because really it's basically solving the puzzle. So with medications I work with, it's, I look at a person as a puzzle. I'm trying to figure out a puzzle. Hmm. And so when using medications is the way I call the puzzle pieces. So I explained, so in the first book, it was art. And then the second book is the puzzle part, because I love puzzles. And so. So then I closed that book with that, but I was realizing that I wanted to write for patients and doctors, but I really realized
okay.
that the first two books were probably more patients than doctors, but also both. And then the third book, I thought, okay, well, this book is going to be more for doctors. And so the third book focuses more on, like, how to take a good history, you know, how to take a good genetic, you know, so basically focusing on more things that doctors should know. But at the same time, I wrote it and I've had many patients read all three, and they go, they love the third one. I go, you didn't get bored with the third one? I go, no, not at all. A few of them told me, you know, it's interesting because it helps me to understand how doctors think. Mm-hmm. And because you put in there your recommendations for doctors, and I thought, they said it's interesting because, you know, my other doctors never did that. They never did that with me. They never thought that way. And mm-hmm. that's what difference with you is, you know, and so a lot of them, I didn't think about it for patients, but yeah, but you know, there's a huge chapter on medication. So I list every medication that's out there that I've worked with. Very, very detailed chapter. So, you know, a lot of the third book I thought will probably be too boring for most people, especially certain chapters like that one. And there's a lot of medication stuff in that book. And so that's why the third book is really, you know, really more the doctor's one. So
have you found that genetics plays a part in this?
Yeah, genetics is the biggest part. Absolutely. So when I take a history, when someone has like an anxiety disorder or depression, bipolar or whatever, it's almost always a genetic component. And then a lot of times it's hard to pick that out because people say, no, I don't think so. I go, well, tell me about your mom and dad. Let me see. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was always a chronic worrier. And I go, well, maybe your mom was anxious and maybe your dad's self-medicating his anxiety or depression. And how about his parents? Yeah, my dad, my grandpa, he was an alcoholic too. But see, people back then didn't talk in the terms of depression, anxiety, things like that, like mm-hmm. a couple generations ago. So when you take family history, you have to really pick it out and you have to really look for details. But yeah, genetics is definitely the number one cause. And this is why people can't help it. You know, some people have the greatest of lives. You know, there's people out there, there's celebrities out there that have everything you would want in life. You would think they're rich, they're famous. You would think they have no worries. Well, why are they depressed? Why are they anxious?
Right.
You know, you have to think about, like, why are people here to have everything in life feeling this way? You know, and
right.
why are some people who have nothing, who are just, you know, when I worked in downtown LA, you know, I worked with, you know, very poor people who seemed to be really mm-hmm. happy, you know, and it's like, gosh, how come these people are barely scraping by and really happy? And now people, so it didn't make sense but when you look at genetics, it makes sense. You know, I mean, why would Robin Williams kill himself? You know, why would, you know,
right.
Twitch, the dancer, why would he kill himself?
They, right.
You know, isn't he the happy guy? So it doesn't make
right.
sense, you know? So, mm-hmm. so that, the second factor I said is hormonal changes. Well, we can't help our hormonal, where we are in life hormonally. We can't help when we're in menopause. We can't help when we have a
right.
child and go through postpartum. And, you know, and we can't help when we have trauma, because trauma can definitely affect things too. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
so the majority of what causes these imbalances, we have no control over. So,
you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the word anxiety a few times, and I had a podcast on this subject a year or so ago, about anxiety, and I didn't understand the definition of anxiety until we talked about this, and she said anxiety is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I went,
yep.
Oh, so sometimes, you know, sometimes you could use the word anxious and go anxious. Oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to go to the Dodger game today. I'm really excited about that. That's a different definition of anxious. But I think
right.
when we're talking psychologically, anxiety, you know, when those shoulders come back up by your ears, you know, because you're really anxious
right.
about something, you're worried, you're concerned, you know,
right.
you've been through this before, it looks familiar, and you didn't like it then, and you don't like it now. I mean, I can see where, you know, therapy, PTSD is perfectly a person that would probably really benefit by the things that you are talking
Absolutely.
About, right?
Yep.
Well, so you,
yeah,
that's
the trauma. I mean, yeah, that's the trauma part, you know. So if someone is traumatized or, you know, a victim of a crime, a rape victim,
sure.
witnessing or almost being murdered, witnessing a murder, you know, so mm-hmm. extremely traumatic events, you know, and, you know, being sexually abused as a child, you know, being a victim of a pedophile. I mean, all these things are, you know, just really cause so much trauma that, you know, it's really difficult to get past that.
Absolutely. So I know the book that I was familiar with was I thought was your fourth book. So maybe you'll tell me what the fifth book is the Corona Protocol. And I thought we could spend some time talking about the focus of this particular book, this latest. Well, I guess is there Corona Protocol Part 2? Is that what the other book is?
No. So the book four, after the first three, the book four, I've named it since then, the Corona Protocol Prescriber's Guide. The Corona Protocol Prescriber's Guide is book four. And book five is the Corona Protocol, the Corona Protocol three Secrets to Success. So I named those like after I did the sixth one, because that's when I came up with the title of the Corona Protocol. And that's why the Corona Protocol being my method, my branding in a sense. Then I named the fourth and fifth books, and the fourth and fifth books are done. It's just, I've chosen not release them yet. Cause I want to work on the teaching part, how to develop a teaching program. And then I'll do that later. So I'm not in a rush to get those out. So,
well, I would just like to mention while we're speaking, and this will obviously, I'll make sure that this is on my blog, for people that are listening and are interested in visiting your website, which is outstanding, you would just go to Dr. Paul Corona, just like the beer, MD.com. And and because I noticed, because those other books are not listed there because you haven't published them yet. But
right.
When we get back to talking about the protocol, you mentioned the three secrets to success. Would you mind sharing what those might be?
The first thing, and then, again, these are for doctors, but I personally think the patients will be interested in both of these books too, because they can use them as reference guides. They can use it as again also seeing how we think and how. So sometimes if I explain it to doctors and doctors aren't reading it, then patients can understand it and then take it to their doctor and say, hey, can you do this? Yeah, he mentioned this in the book. Can you try this? So I'm really writing them mostly for doctors, and PAs and NPs, but also I have in mind patients would probably find them interesting too. Because if doctors aren't going to change, maybe I can help patients force doctors to change. So the first secret is the mind body connection. Explain to doctors again, especially if they haven't read my first three, like what the mind body connection means, and so that's one. Secret number two is understanding the full spectrum of bipolar disorder. So bipolar disorder is a really big subject. It's a big subject about the different variations from mild, moderate to severe. And doctors most of the time don't understand. They might understand the severe bipolar one, the manic. They might understand that one, but they don't understand the bipolar depression. They don't understand the more subtle variations. So that's secret number two. Secret number three is the importance of getting people to remission. So most doctors don't do that. They don't get people completely well. They get them partly well, and then they drop the ball. And then they say, oh, but are you feeling better? Yeah, I'm feeling better, but. Oh, okay, well, go get some more exercise. But yeah, but I'm still tired all the time. Oh, okay, well, get some exercise and you'll be fine. So doctors blow it off and they just kind of just like, this is good enough. I got you feeling better. At least you're not suicidal anymore. And then they drop and then they stop. And so that's why getting people to remission is the third secret. So that's the three secrets. And then that led to the sixth book, which I started writing about 5 years ago. And at the time I thought, okay, I wrote the first five and I thought, okay, now what am I going to do? And I didn't think I was going to write it, but I took a few months off and just thinking about it. And I thought, I want to write a book that's really different. I want to write a book that focuses on storytelling. I'm a fiction buff. I love fiction. I'm a fantasy buff, especially fantasy novels. So I've read fantasy novels, starting with C.S. Lewis and when I was young, as my whole life. And so I thought, I want to write some fiction, because fiction is always something I've dreamed of writing. I just never thought I was good enough to write fiction. Because I read these amazing fiction novelists, J.K. Rowling and all these people who read these amazing writers. I thought, I can't do that. I can't write like that person does. And so, but I thought, you know, but what I do know is stories. I've had over 150,000 office visits in my years. And so I've heard a lot of stories from patients. So I thought, you know what? I want to write a storytelling book. And so I separated into six sections. And I tell 30 original stories. So the first chapter, first section is anxiety, depression, bipolar, ADD. Second section is PTSD, eating disorders, schizophrenia. So the second section is more difficult stuff to treat. The third section is on personality disorders. So I talk about narcissists, people who are histrionic, overly emotional, borderline personality disorder, which is a tough person, and then sociopaths or psychopaths, you know. The fourth section, I talk about the subtitle subjects in my book. So my book, again, is called The Corona Protocol, a scientifically proven medical solution to stop addiction, bullying, homelessness, school shootings, and suicide, 30 years in the making. So in the fourth section, I talk about addiction and bullying and home. So what I do, and I talk about those five subjects in section four. And then in section five, I tell my story from start to finish. And in chapter six, I tell a lot about personal stuff I've gone through and struggles I've gone through and how I've triumphed through them. And but I basically, in this book, what I do is I briefly talk about a subject. And then I do a lot of references to my first three books. And say, hey, if you want to read more about this or that, go to chapter, this book, chapter, whatever. So I reference, if you want to read more in depth, then go to my first three books. But I do a very brief talk, and then I launch into a story about that. And that's the crux of this book is the stories. And I've gotten rave reviews. I've had patients read it, and they've loved it. I've got five-star rating on Amazon. I've gotten a really good response. And people just say they love the stories. They can relate to some of them. And then some of them said, is that story about me? And I go, it might. Some of the stories are, with seeing so many people, there's different parts of people in my stories, but a lot of it's fiction, a lot of it's made up, and I embellish on certain things. I've had a lot of fun, even though it's a lot of work in writing this book. I've had a lot of fun with it because it's just fun to get into the storytelling. But it's been a lot of work, a lot of editing, a lot of, again, to take 5 years to write this one, it means I put a lot of time and effort into it to make sure it was perfect. And I got it professionally edited. I'm working with a really good marketing company called Black Chateau, and they're marketing the book with me. Now my push is this book, and also maybe selling the first three books more. And then that'll lead branch into the next, the two books that aren't released. That'll be we're going to probably start working on those later this year.
Wonderful. Do you write every day?
I read a book by Stephen King. It's called On Writing, and his advice is read every day and write every day. I don't follow that advice. I go through spurts. I go through writing spurts where I have a weekend free and I'll get a bunch done, but then I'll take a break. So I'm kind of off and on. What I do is I do a lot of reading. So I'll write for a while and then I'll read a book or two and then I'll go back to writing and then I'll go back to reading. So I trade off the reading. So when I'm writing, I can't read. I'm just too focused on writing. And when I'm reading, I'm so focused on the book that I don't want to write. So I usually try to break it up.
Well, it kind of leads me to a word that's really important to me, and I think this is exactly what you're talking about, which is balance. And it's not can you walk a tightrope, but so how do you balance your professional and your personal life so that you stay in balance?
Well, I have a great supportive family. My wife will be 32 years this week, next week.
Nice.
I got two, a son and a daughter. And my cat Seymour. So I'm a cat guy, and I've had cats my whole life. So Seymour is
so
if you want to go if you go on my Instagram page, you can see Seymour. But yeah, he's my emotional support animal. So he's my, you know, he gives me a lot of comfort, and I just love spending time with him. And he like he's definitely a daddy's boy. So he's
funny.
You know, yeah, and he yeah.
Well, do you exercise? How do you rekindle yourself?
So I walk every morning, about 3 miles. I walk 7 days
Me
a week.
Too.
So, you know,
too.
I walk about, I power walk every day. So I power walk about 45 minutes every morning before work. Mm-hmm. And even Saturday and Sunday, I do it. And so that's my routine is power walking.
That's pretty cool. I wouldn't say I power walk, but I do have that Google Watch and it's connected to my phone. And I do close those rings, as they say, and I do walk over 3 miles a day. I probably spend an hour doing it as opposed to 45 minutes. But that's not the point. It's not a contest, and I understand that as well. The fact that I do it is I take that very serious, to be honest with you. Sometimes my kids look at me like, God, Mom, it's like, no, you don't understand. There's a lot of things I don't have control over. I have control over doing that. Even when it's rained, and we've had, you know, we've had a lot of rain, and I walk outdoors as you do, and it was like, well, dang, it's raining. Now what? I don't know what you did. I went to the mall, and I just walked.
Yep.
I just walked around and around and around and around in the mall, and I thought, holy cow, it's supposed to rain on Easter, which was yesterday. I thought there are no malls open on Easter, but we didn't get any rain. Thank you very much, so weather god. So I was able to actually walk yesterday, which I was grateful for.
Me too.
But you can relate to that. So, what's next for you? Where do you see yourself in the next few years? Besides, I know your books.
The books and trying to set together a teaching program, maybe an online program I can teach online using case studies. I have a book that I think I'm done writing medical stuff. You know, I don't really have anything more to say because I've done enough.
Been there, done that.
So I think, been there, done that. So what I want to do, I've gotten an idea for a fantasy novel when I was like in middle school. I started writing it. I've kind of picked away at it over the years, and so I have a whole probably a trilogy in my mind about a fantasy book, but I don't think I'm not a good enough writer to write fantasy. I don't think it's intimidating because I follow so many amazing authors, so I would love to get someone like a ghostwriter or someone I can work with, like a real fantasy writer that can feed the ideas I have, and then we can. He or she or and I can like put a book together, and then they do the writing and I give the ideas. That's what I would prefer, you know, rather than doing it all myself.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever take
any
time?
And I want to travel. I want to travel.
Said that at the same time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to travel but I'd love to travel. I'd love to do a book tour ideally eventually. I'd love to do lecturing and book signings, all that stuff. And I love traveling and I want to do more and I haven't done it for so long. And so I want to travel. I want to, spread the word. I really want to teach.
Sure.
And that to me would be so relaxing. People are like, oh, you just relax. Look, I'm not one of those people that just lay by the pool and have a martini I need to be doing stuff. And so for me, if I can put travel together with work and do them both at the same time, that would be the ideal for me. And I'm going to be in practice a while. I'm 61. I'm 61 now, and I'm going to be. I'm not. People are you going to retire? I'm not going to retire. I have no plans to retire. And no matter how good the books do, people get concerned like, oh my gosh, you're going to get, you know, you're not going to be wanting to. I go, no, that's not going to be the case. I'm going to stay with full practice, and I want to do everything. I want to do it everything at once.
Well, you know, but it comes back to that balance, because if you're out of balance, then sometimes things don't work out as well. And so to take time for yourself personally, whether it's like you say, you're power walking, do you cook in the family or does your wife do the cooking?
No, I do no cooking. I do the eating. She does the cooking.
Oh, well, what a nice arrangement that you have.
She's an amazing cook. So I'm very fortunate.
That is really great. And do you work? Do you actually see patients 5 days a week?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Full practice. I I see it probably at least 25 people a day, sometimes
wow.
less. But that, yeah, I work Monday through Friday. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm very busy. I have a pretty full practice. But I'm always open to new patients. I'm also open to seeing people virtually. So even
mm-hmm.
patients that are out of state, I can see. So I see a lot of people are out of state, the people who can't make it to Southern California or just
sure.
too far away, especially
sure.
with COVID, you know.
Yes.
With COVID, everyone has really understood that we can do visits by telephone or virtually.
Sure. Well, and I presume that you must take insurance. I don't know that that's a fact, but I
mm-hmm.
would presume that you do.
Some.
Not
some
all doctors.
Yeah.
Yeah, not all
yeah.
physicians do. But,
mm-hmm.
Well, I have found this to be very personally interesting for me personally, and I'm sure those that have listened have also taken something away because, you know, it's not uncommon to have trauma in your life. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we've all had some level
yep.
of trauma. Some are different than others. I mean, for my husband to just suddenly die at the Staples Center wasn't exactly something we had planned that day. And,
right.
You know, so it happens, but it's how you adjust to the happening that's where you come in, Dr. Paul. That's where you come in, and there you were as a little kid being called Dr. Paul, and who would have
mm-hmm.
ever thought all these years later you'd still be Dr. Paul? So
yep.
I just want to thank you for sharing this knowledge base with our listeners, because I think people are going to really find, even if it's not maybe helpful for themselves, maybe it's helpful for a family member. And
mm-hmm.
and I'm just delighted that you were able to spend an hour with me in this first of April. It's just been terrific. So thank you so very much for your
time. It's
been
my pleasure. My pleasure,
okay,
Martha. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, and I bet you probably have a patient to see, so I'm going to let you go.
Yep.
Okay, everybody, tune in next week. My guest next week will be calling from Brisbane, Australia. I know that's very interesting. Okay, everybody, have a great week. Bye for now.